what we've been doing for the last two sessions and what we'll be doing this morning is to look at a few of the parables of Jesus and to try to get a new and fresh understanding of what they meant when they were spoken. First of all, some introductory comments. The parables of Jesus are obviously 2,000 years old, and when we hear them, either in sermons or when we read them, before we even hear them, we sort of think we know what they mean. You know, like yesterday, for example, we talked about, or was it the first time, we talked about the parable of the fourfold soil: good soil, rocky soil, on the path soil, and weedy soil. And all of us in the room could pretty much say that at many times in our life we had heard a sermon, or we had thought that this was a message about us, that it was a story about what kind of soil we might be. And we could recall Pastor Johnson Swenson or Schultz or somebody preaching a sermon about, are you rocky soil, are you good soil, are you a path, or whatever. What I tried to suggest was that there are ways to understand the parables that are fresh and new and perhaps more accurate to their original intent. And so what we're trying to do here is to wipe the blackboard of our memory a little clean. It's impossible, of course, but to wipe it a little clean, and then to go way back and try to re-understand what some of these parables were all about. Now, about the parables of Jesus, some brief introductory comments. They are the oldest, and they are the clearest and cleanest form of Jesus' teaching that we have available to us. They're a unique style to Jesus. And while many of the statements in the New Testament are problematical, the parables of Jesus are one of the cleanest, clearest forms of his teaching, and so an exciting place to come to know who Jesus is and what he was saying. The imagery of his parables is drawn from Palestine, of course, from the farmers, from the city people, from the villages, from the food and the life of Palestine. In addition to that, these parables that Jesus spoke were a creation of his. No rabbi before used parables. Jesus invented the parabolic style of teaching. 150 years after Jesus started using these parables, 150 years after his death and resurrection, other rabbis were, I refer to Jesus as a rabbi because he was called a teacher. 150 years later, Jewish rabbis had adopted this parabolic form of teaching, what the kingdom of God is like, and then they would tell a little story. Jesus started that style. If we remembered him for no other reason, he would be remembered as the inventor of the parable. Now, there are one or two mini parables that were spoken 50 years before Jesus, but there is no one that developed the parable style in the same way that Jesus did. The parables are clear, they're direct, and they're simple. They are so simple and so powerful that a child, when hearing, can say, yes, that's how it is. And for that reason, that's a part of the reason why we continue to remember the parables of Jesus today. Now, 30 years to 60 years after Jesus' death and resurrection, we're giving just a brief review here of the parables. We're going to be talking about some of the parables of Jesus, and I'm giving just a very brief review of parables generally, of the parables of Jesus. And I just said that Jesus invented the parabolic style, as far as we can tell. But now, 30 years to 60 years after Jesus' death and resurrection, something happened to these parables. At one time, they were clean and clear and simple, and every child could say, yes, that's the way it is. But 30 to 60 years later, they began to be interpreted for their deeper, inner, hidden, tricky significance. That is, people began to say, or the teachers began to say, these parables can only be understood if you're really clever. That is, each little line in these parables is significant. So when Jesus is talking about leaven, he doesn't really mean leaven. He means evil. Okay? Or when he's talking about wheat, he doesn't really mean wheat. He means disciples. You know? So this way of understanding the parables allegorically developed. And that was, it is, many would say now, that was a tremendous loss, because from that time, really from the first century until about 60 or 70 years ago, the parables were always understood allegorically. That means that in order to understand them, you had to have some very wise biblical scholar who could find the deeper, inner, hidden, tricky significance, you see. Well, were they intended for that or not? I suggest, and many New Testament scholars suggest today, that the parables of Jesus were not intended to be understood allegorically for their deeper, inner, hidden, tricky significance, but rather their clean, straightforward message that they have. Okay, we're going to try to look at them in that way. And to do that, we have to understand, as best we can, why they were originally spoken, in what situation they were originally spoken, and we have to understand some of the culture around them that would give, that would help us understand them. We also will understand that the parables were generally defenses that Jesus put forth to those who were criticizing his gospel message. They were not primarily gospel proclamation, but they were defenses of that gospel. In other words, people were mad at him because he ate with the wrong folks, and he did the wrong things on the Sabbath. So the parables were a way of saying, I'll tell you why I do this, folks, and this is why I do it. Okay, they were defenses. In addition to being defenses, they were also ways in which he was trying to win over the opposition. So they were not hostile or defensive statements. They were loving statements that were at the same time telling the people why he was doing this, but at the same time trying to win them over to himself and to the gospel. So that's a background generally of the parables and how they work. Now, there are different ways to categorize the parables. There are many different categories. One category that we've been working with this week is a theme called the Great Assurance. I'm suggesting, and these are not my suggestions necessarily, but they come from fellows like C.H. Dodd and Joachim Jeremias and other people like that that write and do a lot of studying about New Testament. They're suggesting that there are a lot of different themes for these parables. In other words, you can take this theme and there are four parables that speak to that theme. Here's another theme and there are 12 parables to that one. Well, the theme we're looking at, of the many that we could look at, is a theme called the Great Assurance. And under the theme of the Great Assurance, there are six parables. Now, we've been through four of those parables, and today we're going to do the last two of those six. Okay, that's by way of introduction. Are we clean and clear with that? Are we okay? We're ready to go. All right. Now, just to catch up a little bit, under the theme, the Great Assurance, we have looked at the parable of the mustard seed growing into the bush. We have also looked at the leaven making the loaf grow. Those are parallel parables, we've suggested, and those parallel parables are for the purpose of saying, look what a small beginning turns into a great thing. They are ways in which Jesus is saying to the disciples and to the people following him, this is going to work. You may not think it's going to work. We certainly look like a ragtag bunch of losers here, but it's going to work. And he tells the story of the small seed to the big bush, the leaven to the loaf, for the purpose of assuring the people that are with him that this gospel message is going to work. One interesting thing that we'll look at is the way in which Jesus, that we did talk about, was the way in which Jesus took common understandings of his time and turned them around. Like, for example, the seed to the bush. Any good Jew of the time understood that, you and I understand that if we put a tree in the corner, a green evergreen, and hang green and red lights on it, what time of the year is it? You got that, right? Everybody understands that's a Christmas tree. Any Jew of the time would understand that a bush housing birds is a symbol. Any Jew would understand that to be a symbol of the state, the military might of the state protecting the citizens. Jesus says of himself, I am that bush. The kingdom is that bush. He just changes that picture around. They understood that bush to be a picture of military power. Jesus says that applies, guess what? To me. You know, and the people's minds just went, just crashed all over the place, you see, because it was such a startling change. How could he claim that? You know? But a way in which he kind of dramatized his gospel was to say that's one way he changed the imagery around. And he does that all through the parables, surprising people. It's not really possible to understand many of the parables unless you have a sense of humor. And you could picture the Jewish people listening to these things, and with their background and their understanding of life, and some of the things that he said, they just must have fallen over, you know. Or they certainly went away tittering, or believing, or gossiping, or talking. They couldn't leave it cold, because the imagery was just so radically changed. Now, we've looked at four different parables. We'll not review those four, but what we're going to do now is turn to the last two parables that continue this theme of assurance. And we're going to look at Luke 18:2. Luke 18:2, please. Theme, assurance. Assurance, dear friend, that this ragtag bunch of people are in fact the kingdom of God. All right. Now, we've looked at one more introductory comment. We've looked at four parables so far in the last 2 days that in which Jesus was saying, I am confident of what's happening. Now, in the two parables we're going to look at this morning, Jesus is telling the people following him why they should be confident. Because probably they were saying, well, that's fine for you, Jesus. You think this is a really good idea. But we don't think it's such a good idea. In fact, we can't see why this is working at all. Why should we be so happy as you're happy? Now he gives two parables that attempt to say this is why you should be so confident that the gospel is going to work. Luke 18:2, the parable of the unjust judge. Will someone read for us, please?
He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor regarded man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, vindicate me against my adversary. For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor regard man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will vindicate her, or she will wear me out by her continual coming. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. And will not God vindicate his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will vindicate them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth?
I should have asked you to start with 18:1.
Oh,
my fault. Let me read 18:1. Then Jesus told his disciples a parable to teach them that they should always pray and never become discouraged. Underline pray with your... just kind of say out loud what this means. What you've come to understand this parable to mean. Can you? What is it about? What's it say? Right from our immediate reading of it. Go ahead. Just a few sentences, a few ideas. Just throw them out. We'll see where we go here.
It reminds me of another place where he talks about how God even watches the sparrows and the number of hairs on your head are numbered in this country. And it's sort of, even a judge who doesn't care much for anything or anybody is finally going to see justice done. God will do it that much more speedily because he knows it.
Yes. Okay.
If you pester long enough, they'll give you...
Pester. Big word here. Pester. Irritate the judge.
They just finally get weary and say, oh.
Go ahead. Any other comments? What's it mean, 18:2? Let me go verse by verse now, please. Then, and then make some comments at the end. Verse 1, we'll start one. This is a parable about how to pray. Notice that? See the word prayer in there? So says the introduction. But the parable, in Luke at least, is clearly linked up to the next parable. What's the next parable? Excuse me?
The next parable?
Parable? Yes?
Tax collector and the Pharisee.
Okay. Luke, in his early manuscript of the thing, clearly links up the parable we're looking at with the parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee. But the tax collector and the Pharisee parable has nothing at all to do with prayer. I mean, it simply doesn't have anything at all to do with that. At least it doesn't appear to. But yet, the heading of prayer, and then Luke has two parables. It's possible that this parable then was spoken not about prayer, but about, originally, not about prayer maybe, but about something else. And Luke inserted this this line about prayer in verse 1, and then put these two parables underneath. So while it says that this is a parable about prayer, let's just wait on that for a minute. Maybe it is, maybe it's not, but let's not make any assumptions. Let's try to look at the parable and try to find out what Jesus meant originally when he spoke it from the context of the parable itself. Because Luke, you see, assembled these things some 40 years after they were originally spoken. So it's possible that Luke interpreted the parable as being about prayer when in fact maybe it wasn't about prayer at all. Okay, verse 2. Doesn't respect God or man, that is, it doesn't care what anyone says about him, right? Is that what that says? Doesn't the judge really doesn't care what anybody thinks. Verse 3, the widow. Now, widow doesn't necessarily mean an older woman. The marriage age was common at age 13 or 14, so the woman could have been a widow at 15. So we shouldn't assume that she was old. She brings her case not to a tribunal, but she brings her case to a single judge. That's significant. If it was, since she brings it to a single judge, the problem probably was over money. Maybe inheritance, or maybe, you know, I'm not getting money from my father-in-law, my husband died, and I'm supposed to get part of the farm, and I'm not getting any of the farm, or something like that. It was probably a money matter. If it was a bigger matter than that, it would go to a tribunal, but it's to a single judge. Okay. Now, she isn't able to bribe the judge. She doesn't have enough money for that. Her only way to win this contest is by persistence, that is, nagging. Or what's the word you used earlier?
Pestering.
Okay. Verse 4. The judge would not give an answer to the question at hand. In the Greek it says, he would not venture. In other words, he just said, oh, I have to think about it a while. He wouldn't say, for sure. It's possible that he wouldn't give an answer because the opponent in the case had more influence than this young widow, or this widow who was perhaps very young. Anyway, he knew the opponents probably, and he wouldn't give an answer to the case. Verse 5, the judge finally yields because the widow simply gets on his nerves. Notice the reference in verse 5. This widow. See, underline this. That's kind of a nasty comment when this is inserted. In the parable of the prodigal son, the oldest son refers to the youngest son when talking to the dad as this son of yours. Okay. Now, to us, maybe that doesn't mean a whole lot, but in the context in which it was written, when the woman was referred to as this woman, it's kind of saying, you know, she's driving me nuts. I can't stand this lady anymore. This woman, a word of slander and kind of spiteful reference. Verse 7. There is, I think, the most accurate translation of 7 might be this. Will not God hasten to rescue his elect who cry to him day and night, even if he puts their patience to the test? Once more, will not God hasten to rescue his elect who cry to him day and night, even if he puts their patience to the test? Now, verse 8. Speedily means that God will help them suddenly, that he will help them in kind of an unexpected way. Now, the end of the parable in verse 8b, the parable ends with a surprising line. It's kind of a very serious and somber end. The parable goes on, and then all of a sudden, this very, very serious comment, nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? I mean, it seems a little out of context to the parable. Does it feel that way to you? You feel all of a sudden this thing was inserted. Well, what, you know, excuse me, I'm sorry, you know, all of this heavy thing gets put in here. Okay. This parable is closely linked, as I said just a minute ago, to the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector below. But the parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee does not have anything to do with prayer, and it's possible that this one doesn't either. The central figure of the parable is the persistent woman.
How many books say avenge?
Excuse me?
How many of the Bibles use the word avenge?
Avenge.
King James does.
Yeah. I was wondering why in that particular avenge, usually, you know, in my interpretation, that means to get even.
Yeah.
More or less.
Right.
There has to be a wrongdoing before you can avenge.
It could, well, The King James English is 450 years old now.
What have you got? What translation? Jerusalem?
What's it say?
See justice done.
See justice done.
Okay. That's a little more fair than avenge, isn't it?
Yes.
Avenge sounds like you're going to go out and smack somebody.
Well, this is why I asked, because it several times refers to avenge in here, and that would seem like she was trying to get retribution for something.
Right. One of the difficulties in using a 450-year-old translation is that the words have obviously changed through the centuries, and what avenge means to us meant something different in 1611 when that was assembled.
This judge could have taken vengeance against her by giving her an unfair settlement.
She could have.
Yes.
Uh huh.
Didn't.
And he didn't.
No, he didn't.
The New Testament said he will defend and protect and avenge them speedily. In the Revised Standard says, "And will God not vindicate his elect?" And he said, "I will vindicate her, or she will wear me out."
Vindicate. The Jerusalem helps us over here, doesn't it, when it says, when it talks about justice. That's a word that's cleaner for us than venge, or what's the word?
Vindicate.
Vindicate. You know, it's a cleaner, easier word somehow for us. Okay. The central figure of the parable is the persistent woman, but notice how Jesus interprets the story starting in verse 8. He shows that he wants the people to concentrate not on the persistent woman, but he wants the parable to be concentrated on who?
The judge.
The judge, right, not on the woman. Evidently, Jesus expected people to come up with conclusions about the judge, namely, that if this inconsiderate judge who refused to hear the woman's case finally gives in simply to get rid of her, how much more, and underline that, please, if the judge would do this, how much more then would God give justice and love and care for his people? The faithful people are his chosen ones. They are the ones that he has compassion for. How much more then, in comparison, this judge to the woman, would God be to his people? Remember, the theme that we're looking at is the great assurance. How much more, Jesus is saying, this kind of assurance from God. Now, to whom is the parable addressed? Look in 8a. It's probably addressed to the disciples. And he probably told them this parable because they were worried that things were not going to work out. He told them the parable because they were in a troubled situation, and so he is asking them, can you hang on? Yes, he is saying, can you hang on? Yes, you can hang on. This assurance comes from God. Just like the judge cared for the woman, how much more then will God care for us? In the face of the troubles, Jesus is saying, hold on, you are the chosen ones, God will hear your cry. Do not doubt his power, do not doubt his goodness, do not doubt his help. If you want to be concerned with something, be concerned with this. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith? Okay? If you want to fret, go ahead and fret, but don't fret over God. Fret over when God comes, will he find faith? That's worth worrying about. Okay. Now, that's one way of understanding that last line. Now, so, then, why should we be confident that God will work his miracles? Because that's the way God is. If this crummy old judge will listen, how much more will God listen? Be assured that from... Now, we're going to go back a little bit from the first parable. Be assured that from the mustard seed there will come the tree to shelter the people. Be assured that from the small little leaven will come the great loaf that is the people of the kingdom. Be assured that the harvest will come even if the seed is thrown in impossible places. Those are the other parables we looked at. Now be assured that God is a loving God, just like the judge. Even more so. How much more? Okay, a parable of assurance.
It seems to me kind of that he assures them that God's there, but are there going to be enough people that are going to have faith to keep on coming to him for their power?
Right.
So it throws it back at them that God's not in question, you are.
Yeah, okay. Yes. And we're ready to move on to the last of these six parables now. You want to say some more words about the unjust judge that changes his mind and say anything about...
Well, how about the poor guy that was avenged against?
The who?
The poor guy that was avenged against. The lady won, the other guy had to lose.
Right.
Not necessarily. Maybe what he had wasn't his tools and stuff. He may just even things up.
You don't know that, though.
No, I don't.
You have to take that with a grain of salt and faith.
The last parable that is in this category, the last of the six parables in this category called the Great Assurance, is the parable of the neighbor who comes and knocks at midnight and asks for bread. Remember that parable? Okay, that's also in Luke. It's in the fifth chapter of Luke. Excuse me, it's in the 11th chapter of Luke. Luke 11, 5. Before we go into this, this is kind of a little insert I'll make that's not about the parable, not about what we're studying here, but about the process. And that is that the last thing I am is a New Testament scholar. These people that work on this day and night are the people that have the ability to do that are few and far between. But and I am certainly not one of those people. I read what other people write, and I try to understand it for myself, and then I'm sharing that with you. I'm sharing things from a man named Joachim Jeremias, a good old German scholar with black shined shoes, I suppose, and a fellow by the name of C.H. Dodd, and a number of other scholars like that. I'm not a New Testament scholar. So what I read their books, try to understand them, and then I'm sharing that with you. So I welcome any kind of comment that you have that this stuff is really not right or not accurate or not to the point. So I'm certainly not going to feel bad if you say that's a rotten idea, you know, because I'm just trying to sift what I have read and share it with you. Okay, I want you to understand that. Now, in this last of the six parables, Luke 11, here is a description of life within a Palestinian village, and we can learn an awful lot about Palestine from the parables. Just a tremendous number of things. We're going to learn a lot from this one. One of the principles of our interpretation of the parables is that if we put ourselves back into the time of that Jesus actually spoke these and into the situation in which they were spoken, they're going to mean a whole lot more to us. Now, we're going to go through some of the details of this parable, and I think we'll see that understanding the parable is really dependent in part on understanding the nature of a bolt and a door, understanding bread, how much bread people ate, understanding the daily schedule, when Mama cooked the bread in the morning, or did she cook in the afternoon, and what visitors coming to call meant, and all of that stuff. If we ignore that, we're going to have a much more risky time understanding the parable as it was originally spoken. Okay, so let's have someone read, please. Luke 11:5.
And Jesus said to his disciples, suppose one of you should go to a friend's house at midnight and say to him, friend, let me borrow 3 loaves of bread. A friend of mine who is on a trip has just come to my house and I don't have any food from him. So suppose your friend should answer from inside, don't bother me, the door is already locked and my children and I are in bed. I can't get up and give you anything. Well, what then? I tell you that even if he will not get up and give you the bread because you are his friend, yet he will get up and give you everything you need because you are not ashamed to keep on asking. And I say to you, asking you will receive, seeking you will find, knock and the door will be open to you. For everyone who asks will receive, and he who seeks will find, and the door will be open to anyone who knocks.
Okay, that's far enough right there. What precedes the parable?
Lord's Prayer.
Evidently, what's the parable about?
Prayer.
Ask and you will? Or seek and you will find, ask and it shall be given. Okay. Again, like in the last one, I'm going to ask you to, for a minute, just lift this story out of the Bible at this point. Disassociate it from the Lord's Prayer and disassociate it from ask and you will find, knock and it will be opened. Okay? Lift the story of the visitor coming at night knocking on the door out of here and understand that Luke assembled this 40 years after Jesus spoke it. and let's let it stand by itself and see if, standing by itself, it can take on some new and some fresh meanings. Okay. Obviously, I'm leading you down a primrose path. I want you to come to the point where you say, aha, that is about the great assurance, too. You know you're being led, so let's all acknowledge it. Verse 5. Evidently a small town. There are no shops here. No places to go out to buy bread. Safeway is in the big town down the street. Okay?
They're talking about midnight.
Pardon me?
They're talking about midnight.
Right, 7-Eleven's open, though. Thank heaven for 7-Eleven.
You're on the up here.
Right, not Railroad Creek, anyway.
Thank you for that.
Okay, that's for sure. Okay. Bread is baked before the sun comes up, unless it's July, and then it's baked as the sun comes up. But it's baked first thing in the morning, and the woman of the house bakes the bread. Now, in small villages, there are no shops. So they are self-sustaining in these small villages, and it's probably the way in the village being described in Jesus' parable here, since they couldn't go out and buy anything, and of course you make reference to midnight, which of course doesn't, which eliminates the possibility that it is a small town. But if it is a small village, it is generally known who's got bread left at the end of the day. You know, we know what's going on in Holden Village. Small place, right? You know what's happening around here, at least with a lot of folks. In a small Palestinian village, one of the things that people know is, at 9 o'clock at night, who's got some bread left? Because it's a lot of work to stoke up the fire, and to get at the right temperature, and to knead that bread, and to make, you can't do it late at night. So people know who has the bread at the end of the day. 3 loaves would be common for one person to eat at one meal. Now, a loaf obviously is not, Wonder Bread. A loaf is, what is it? Anybody heard about biblical loaves? I never have heard, but evidently they must be like a big biscuit, hot dog, a hamburger bun or something like that. 3 of those for a meal per person was common. Now, the person asks to borrow, not to have. That would be normal, that you would borrow the bread. You would certainly return it the next day. Verse 6, the guest comes to visit. The option of feeding the guest is no option. It's simply done. Now, if we are so far from that time, if the relatives call at 10 o'clock at night and they're down at the Texaco station, you can say, well, there's a motel right around the corner and there's a 24-hour Sambo's there. But in Palestine, there is no 24-hour Sambo's and there is no motel around the corner. Hospitality to travelers was not an option. And it was a sacred obligation. And what were the options? Death, out in the cold maybe, or hunger, or robbers, or wild animals. Getting somebody inside of your house and taking care of them was simply protecting the whole culture. So this knock at midnight is an extremely serious thing, you see. Kind of reminds me of a way in North Dakota, if the blizzard was on or if winter was there and somebody would come by and knock on the door and you didn't know them, well, then you'd get to know them, wouldn't you? And you wouldn't say, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to go another 12 miles into Bismarck because I don't know you. I'm not going to let you in the house here. Well, between your house, your farm, and Bismarck, if the person died, it'd be in the paper. And then the next week or next 2 years or so, people would say, why didn't you let the person in your house? And you'd answer, well, I didn't know him. They'd say, well, so what? You didn't know him. You don't leave people out in a storm, no matter who, if you don't know them or not. Now, in California, people knock at the door at 10 o'clock at night. And you don't let them in because they're, A, not going to freeze, and you don't know what they want and what they're all about. At least, when people knock late at night on my door, I used to get kind of nervous about that because it was a whole different situation. But in a hostile environment or an environment that was not completely hospitable, this knock at midnight was an extremely important thing. It was a sacramental kind of event, you see. Now, verse 7. Ancient Middle Eastern people go to bed early. The work is done mostly in the pre-dawn, and it's not done late at night. In July, Wolfgang Roth was here from Chicago. You saw some of the things that he brought with him. He brought oil lamps. Who could describe them? Fit in your hand.
Candles.
Yeah. Right. So that was the light at night. Very, very small. So this late evening work was simply not practical. These people went to bed very, very early. There was no tonight show to stay up and watch. That was for sure. Okay. Now, the door shut means that it was closed and it was bolted. The bolt was either wooden or it was iron, and it was a bar pushed through the door. The doors had rings on them, you know, like 3-inch rings, and a number of them. So to get that bolt in the door, it wasn't simply like we would do to walk over and grab it and go click, click. That wasn't it. You'd go over and you'd pick up the bolt, and you'd walk over and you'd slide it clankety, clankety, clank through the rings. You know? The bolt was this long, and it extended across the whole door, held by various rings. So, it's not simply a question of turning on the light, going to get a little bread. That's not the point. The point is, there's this big noisy bolt that has to be drug out of the door. In addition, the children are asleep in bed with me. The sleeping portion of the house was a raised part off to the side. And everybody, mom and dad, just like the Eskimos and the kids, everybody was cozy and warm. They all slept together on the raised part over here. So if dad's going to get up, unbolt the door, get the bread, which they don't have, he's going to wake up mama, he's going to wake up the kids, right? So that's a part of what is going on for this visitor to come late at night. I cannot get up really means I won't get up. If he could get up if he wanted to, but it's just so inconvenient, it's dark, the children, wife, all that kind of stuff. Now, verse 8, yet you will get up, won't you? Because the neighbor keeps on asking. What was the theme in the last parable?
Persistence.
Persistence. The neighbor keeps on asking. That's the correct translation here. Okay, now some comments about this whole thing. The parable comes to us in the context of the Lord's Prayer. You notice that at the top of verse of chapter 11. But there is a question whether or not the parable originally applied to prayer at all. A number of people suggest that this parable is out of context in this situation. Even if it is in the right place, let's try to understand it in its original setting. Oh, just by it's a story as opposed to a reporting of an actual event or something. It's got that story flavor to it. Here's this person and the knock and the bread, and it's...
It doesn't start off factual.
I am challenging your...
assumption that it's a
says,
parable?
Which of you shall have a friend? So it wasn't talking about an actual, it just says which of you would have a friend.
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
so it's generalizing.
All the rest of the parables say that he used this parable for such and such.
Mm-hmm.
This one doesn't.
This does not have, no, it doesn't have that same introduction, but it does have the characteristics of a parable, and from the phrase that was mentioned here, it indicates that it is a supposed idea, which...
I'm not disputing the fact that it isn't. I just want to know how you come
It isn't
out.
Marked off in the same clear way, however, you're right. Yeah.
If I read by it, I wouldn't recognize it as a parable of such.
If it was factually, we would have said there was a friend.
Yeah. Please look at the phrase, which of you? You find that? Where is that? Which verse? Okay. 10 times in the New Testament, the parables of Jesus start with the phrase, which of you? And then he goes on to finish the parable. In all 10 examples, which of you, excuse me, in 9 of the 10 examples, this one excluded, in 9 of the 10 examples, which of you can be answered only with an emphatic no? In other words, the parables of Jesus that start with which of you have an automatic answer. No is the automatic answer. It's kind of like a cheer, a college football cheer, you know, give me an A, and everybody's going to say A, right? They're not going to say B, they're going to say A. Jesus says, which of you? And they know the parable's going to come, and they know that the answer is going to be no. Okay? Now just remember that for a minute, and we'll go through here. A clear translation of the which of you is this. Can you possibly imagine, and then he goes on to tell the story, can you possibly imagine somebody turning away a visitor at night? For us, we could say, could you possibly imagine serving coffee, serving donuts or some sort of cake without coffee? Well, maybe you could, you'd serve milk. But could you imagine that? No, I could hardly imagine it. Could you imagine telling your relatives to go someplace else when they were passing through town? No, you couldn't imagine doing that. You just wouldn't do it. Can you possibly imagine? No, the answer is not. Even more so in the Mideast culture, when hospitality for travelers was of grave importance, it was a life and death situation. Can you possibly imagine turning away a visitor who would come at night? No, the answer is, you can't turn away a visitor who comes at night. So, when these can you imagine questions come out, 10 times in the New Testament, parables of Jesus, can you imagine? When they come out, the answer is always no, no, no. Now, there's a question being asked here in this parable, therefore. The traditional writing of this parable indicates that the question is over in verse 6. Will you look, please? The tradition, the way it's written in your scriptures there, indicates that the question is concluded at verse 6. But, it is suggested, that's impossible, that the question is over by verse 6. For only the situation has been described up to that point. The question extends all the way through verse 7. Therefore, if this parable is to make any sense at all in its original state, the question that Jesus probably said originally was, can you imagine if you had a friend who came to you at midnight and said to you, friend, lend me 3 loaves because a friend of mine has come on our journey, I have nothing to feed you. Would you call out, don't bother me? Can you imagine such a thing? Okay. In the scriptures, the question ends at verse 6, but it probably is that the question should extend all the way through verse 7. The answer is very obvious. Well, it's impossible. Of course you wouldn't turn somebody away. In no circumstances would I leave my friend's request unanswered. So you get up, you unlock the door, you disturb the children, food, friends, and Mideast hospitality certainly are more important than sleeping children. They are much more important than a wife who might be upset or the inconvenience of unbolting the door. I think what Jesus originally meant in this parable was the request that could never be refused. See, the homeowner comes off as the bad guy in the story, right? Is this true?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not likely that's the way it was originally spoken. It's most more likely that it was that the homeowner was very willing to get up. So the story was, can you imagine him complaining? Oh, of course not. He'd never complain. That's probably what it originally meant. So the central figure does not appear to be the one who is asking the question, but rather the one who is inside the door, the homeowner, the one who is roused from sleep. The parable does not have to do with rude neighbors who ask for bread. That is, it doesn't have to do with neighbors who come around when they shouldn't. That is, it doesn't have to do with prayer, probably. But rather, it has to do with petitions that will certainly be granted. It's a good chance, then, that this parable is a parable of assurance, just like the judge parable that we just looked at. Assurance that just as the man would certainly get up from bed, so much more would God act in the same kind of way. All right, those are 6 parables, all about assurance. But now, that's kind of all biblical studies. What does it mean? That's the next question. Because the judge gave in, how much more would God? Confident, because certainly they would not turn away a visitor late at night, nor would God turn you away. Just as the person in the house would be happy to get up and give you bread, so too God, even more so, will happily take care of us. That is the great assurance. Either we have a ho-hum around the fire here, or maybe places in the scriptures where you would be led to be a pesterer. But I don't think from these parables that the point of the parables is to invite you to be a nagger.
No, I don't feel that, but I mean, right. That is just kind of a sideline that
okay.
I get from it.
Yes. All right.
Pestering of God.
That's really hard for me too. And when I started working in counseling with a real assertive kind of approach, teaching kids to meet your needs. You know, you need something, you go out and get it. And it was real hard for me to not think that that was just way out of line. And yet I think he's assuring us that it's really okay just to ask. You know, we need something, keep on knocking. Maybe the answer won't come exactly how we planned it out.
Maybe he doesn't have his mind made up yet.
Well, maybe he does, but just that's our part, you know, not to sit willy-nilly and say, well, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah, I see your
but,
point.
You know, but it's hard for me too.
Maybe it's a persistent look to the pestering, or maybe it's not trying to get God to change his mind, but just so that it's he that we keep on pestering, and not go, you know, not give up on God, and not go to other sources, whatever that may be.
Sometimes during that process when we're asking God for something and we keep on, there's a searching and a purifying in our own heart too. Sometimes motives come out. We have to seek, well, what is my motive in this? Sometimes there's a real cleansing process that goes on with us during this time. And God sees you need that. So he kind of, because we're in the Old Testament, one place where one of the prophets prayed and God said the answer was there, but the forces of Satan held it back for so long. That's in the Old Testament. So sometimes maybe it's a trying time and a growth time for us.
The pestering itself is for our own
growth. Because sometimes we have to sift on attitudes during this time. Why am I asking? And God's purifying motives in our life. Because we, as much as we like to think so, our motives aren't always the purest. And God really sees what they are, you know, to start with, and he might work, do a purifying process for yourself.
I think even though you gave the introduction, and I've heard other introductions, we have a hard time, I have a hard time with parables.
Oh, they're tough.
It's not the way I've been trained. It's not my schooling. I have a Western mind. Yeah. I have an American mind. I think logically, not intuitively. If my culture told Sufi stories, I would be better off than though it teaches me what is the bottom line. Meaning, if you talk to me and I say I didn't follow you, I'll go back because you're A, B, C, D, conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a parable.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing the same thing that Mr. Butler did. What about the guy, this young widow? What about the guy? Well, that's not the point at all, really.
Mm.
That's not, I mean, that the parable, we go back and examine all the details. In fact, we go back on the pestering. And that's not the point. But I'm not sure I'm at the point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're at the hour, but I'm not sure I'm still at the point.
Yeah. This is what
of the great assurance. Because I'm still on the details of the story. That's the way I think.
Yes.
The details of the story. And then I miss the whole point.
Yeah.
I guess the hour really confronted me again with my difficulty of moving in and encountering the Word of God when Jesus, you know, one of the answers is that it said he spoke in parables. He didn't ever preach with or teach without a parable. You can assume if Jesus is talking that it's parabolic. At least there's one scripture verse. And I think we really, I've heard people, seek and you shall find, used in all kinds of ways. You'll get all the money you want. You'll get all the, you know. Well, that's not a
gifts
promise.
Gifts of the Spirit. Right. All
that's
kinds of
things. That's not a
promise.
Right. So it's, I feel like we've just started, and now we ought to get to the parable. I mean,
yes.
I'm not in it yet.
Yeah. To me, well, that's part of the reason why the parables were so messed up for centuries,
yeah,
is because Western people were dealing with them. We were not Mideast or Oriental people.
Yeah.
Western people like to go A, B, C, D, look at all the nitty-gritty little details. And that is part of the reason why we just have a terrible time understanding these things.
I'm not even sure I understand what, if in this last one, chapter 11, if it really ends with 7 instead of 6, and all of the other 9, which of you with the obvious answers no? I'm not even sure I've wrapped myself around that point that you made. I think that's a key point. I'm not even sure I am with that yet. Are all of you with it? The difference of ending?
I was sitting here wondering how I could come to that just reading it.
Yeah.
And there was no way.
Well, I think the hearers could move into it quickly. I really do. Because the common people heard him so gladly. He spoke with authority. The scribes and Pharisees turned him off and they flocked. Mm-hmm. But I don't move into it easily. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As a communication of ordinary people in his time, they kids grasped it. Mm-hmm. And I think are not being kids.
So much junk in the way.
Makes it very difficult for us to move in and hear Jesus speak. I really do.
See, one of the problems is that I like each parable to be about me.
Yeah.
But it's not. You know, I like the fourfold soil to be a way of saying, James, are you good soil, bad soil, rocky soil? It's about a much bigger issue than me. It's about the kingdom of God, after all. You know, I like to put myself in the middle of each parable and think that Jesus told it just for me. Or that I'm the center of the story, but it's not.
Do you remember yesterday, Jim, I was saying that I felt that somehow it's got to be presented so that the educated mind can receive it.
The question you just asked was asked yesterday.
Is that right?
The statement was made, yes. Same question.
Well, there are people who are trying to do that. You mean almost reverse the process so that with our education we somehow get through that and to this truth. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was a very comment you made yesterday.
Yeah.
Same thing.
I think it's Kierkegaard, says, if you're a scholar, you'll have trouble reading the Word of God because you'll say, what does this commentary say? And then but 10 commentaries say, if you're not a scholar, rejoice. You can read the Word of God immediately. Kierkegaard really, really says that you have trouble with too much scholarship, because you're going to examine the mirror instead of seeing yourself in the mirror. If you're an expert on mirrors, you won't see yourself. You'll be examining the mirror. And then you miss what the Word of God is supposed to show you. Luther does almost the same thing. We examine the cradle. The point is the cradle holds a Christ, a person. And we miss that. We spend all of our time examining the cradle and having denominations split over the cradle. Yeah. So,
so many times since I've been here, I've heard people with the proclamation just saying everything that Christ is teaching turns everything we know on its head, you know, turns it upside down. And this summer, I worked with a man who was an artist, and we were looking at a sunset, and he said, God, look at the green, and I went on naming these colors, and I looked at him, I didn't see any of those colors in the sunset. I saw orange and red, that's what you usually see in colors. He said, turn around, put your head between your legs, and now look at that sunset. And when everything was flipped, I saw the green and the yellow and the mauve. But it was like I was so locked into my frame of reference of lake and trees and sky that I saw what I expected to see. But getting out of that frame helped things open up. It was real neat.
Don't you think Jesus covered a lot of it in the statement? He said, except as you become like little children.
Yeah.
Basically, much of Christ's teaching is contrary to our human nature, to really what we want here to start with.
Well, this is what I was trying to get at yesterday, Jim. You've got to get the presentation of the theology into a bracket, whether it has to start in grade school so the children will understand without all the complications that come with college education and growing up and becoming an adult. I'm not sure that might not have to go clear back to there to start, where you have a clean, fresh mind to insert this information that doesn't have the challenges and the questions and all the things that I would. Maybe from there, in that age bracket, you could build a strong Christian world out of this entire world. Whereas at this stage of the game, what is the percentage? Maybe 1 out of 1,000 in the 20, 25-year-old bracket are actually inclined to be even to hold still long enough to listen to the word of any kind.
It's an ancient problem, obviously, because as soon as the gospel left Israel, coffee time. As soon as the gospel left Israel, it went west on a ship to the Western Greek world, and that's where we are today in Holden Village, in the Western Greek world. As soon as the gospel was turned into the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and the Athanasian Creed, it became Greek as opposed to Oriental East, Eastern, you know. And the categories just got switched. But here we are, we're in the Western world, we are not Orientals, and here we are going to live. But the struggle is communicating in this culture, with our mindset, you know, these parabolic stories that should be just as easy as anything to understand.
One attempt that Walt Bowman shared with us this summer, and the bookstore had it, it may be sold out, it's called The Dark Interval, and you'd never know it was about parables by the title, so I'll say it again, The Dark Interval. Small paperback, John Dominic Crosan teaches it to Paul, Roman Catholic writer. His attempt is to show that we have taken them and made them allegories, or we've taken them with our Western mind. What the parables do every time is to subvert our easy answers, just like Libby said. It's to turn things upside down. 70 pages, readable. I think he's trying to speak to educated people, meaning with our kind of education, and letting the parable break through again. It's really a very helpful little book. A lot of people read it this summer.
What was the name of it?
The Dark Interval by Crosan, C-R-O-S-S, either O-N or A-N, John Dominic Crosan. It's an Argus publication, $1.95, I think, paperback. It's really good on parables. Check in the bookstore.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.